The great Errol Garner, Misty, passed away on this day, 1977, so we remember him and his music and other music coming through. We have with us here in the studio Bob Summerby, editor of the Daily Howler, Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, assistant professor of communication and affiliate assistant professor of African and African-American studies at Loyola University, Maryland. In studio, joining us by phone, Edward Wyckoff Williams, author, columnist, political and economic analyst, former investment banker. I need to find out more about that from him. Contributing editor at Root. His column, Elevating the Dialogue, is featured in The Griot, The Root, and Slate. And if we get together in New York, I'm on my way to do Melissa Harris Perry. Maybe we'll find out how to do that. Dr. Anne McCarthy is on the other line, dean of the business school at Hamline University in Minneapolis, and a former Republican candidate for controller here in the state of Maryland. Anne, good to have you back.
Glad to be here. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. It's cold up there where you are.
It's freezing. It might be zero today, and that would be the high.
That would be the high, I know.
Wow.
410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook page and see what you've written there, or you can tweet us at Mark Steiner. We want to hear what you think were the issues of the year. We're clearly going to talk about Trayvon Martin and the Zimmerman verdict and its aftermath. We're going to look at the health care that went into effect in the battle over that, the government shutdown, the Boston Marathon bombing and the Kenya Mall attack, and how those might be tied or not tied to Snowden's disclosures in the NSA and the madness and around that. Marriage equality became a huge issue this year. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court decisions, as well as states all across America, marriage equality now taking on, becoming a fact of life in this country more than it ever has been. This is many things happened during this time, and very quickly. I'm going to do this. And Bill de Blasio was just sworn in as mayor of New York, and a progressive win, and also a man who represents kind of real working people, as Bob Summerby was saying. He also came out of a house with one bathroom.
Four people, one bathroom. That is just a mayor of New York in the year 2013 being elected out of a one bathroom family dwelling. That is a remarkable. No, really, I think a remarkable fact.
It is. I also think it's remarkable too that he just represents diversity, the face of it. I just think that's amazing. I like the fact that he's getting in front of issues, and I want to say Happy New Year to you, Mark, and thank you for inviting me to be on the show. This is Kay, of course.
Good to have you here.
And Happy New Year to my sons; they're listening, so I'm happy about that.
All right.
Today,
Abraham Lincoln had two bathrooms in his childhood home.
That seems to be an issue here.
I think what was most impressive about not just de Blasio but his family is that they actually spent a lot of time considering whether or not they would stay in that house and not move into Gracie Mansion. Can you imagine, like, what their values must be and how solid they must be in order for that to be a decision around which they must wrangle? You know, because they were mostly concerned with Dante being able to finish school with his friends, being in their community. That just goes to show what kind of man that is.
Right. It'd be interesting to see what he is. As a friend of mine said to me when I was in New York a few weeks back, looking at de Blasio becoming mayor on January the 1st, one of the things he said to me, though, was, remember, this is New York City. Yeah. New York City is a place where the financial district has huge power in determining what happens to the future of the city, what policies are going to be, as do the developers that are tied to the bankers and finance industry in a big way. And that's what your mayor, Edward Wyckoff Williams, is up against. It's not going to be like this is not going to be a cakewalk.
No, it isn't. And he's come in quite forcefully. His entire campaign was based on the idea that he was going to raise taxes on those people. And obviously the scare tactic that people like Bloomberg and others were using was that somehow those people would leave the city. I live in New York City. I used to be an investment banker. And let me say, these people can't make the kind of money that they make unless they are in New York. They are not leaving New York.
Right.
So it's all very odd to me that's where a lot of wealthy people who are on the far right default to, because they don't even believe that rhetoric themselves. It'll be interesting to see how he evolves, I would say, over the course of the next few years, because I think we're all aware that as much as politicians might have grand ideas and bold ideas, and I think President Obama and former President Clinton are examples of this, they are forced by virtue of the fact that our politics work the way that they work, they are forced to compromise even their own values sometimes. I hope that Bill de Blasio stays true to the very heart of what he believes in. I believe that that is the case, particularly after interviewing him. This is a man who's very, very fixed. But that doesn't mean that he will necessarily govern well if he stays so fixed. And I don't really know what that's going to look like over the next couple of years.
This is why I was so struck by that New York Times profile of the family home, because money has taken control of every aspect right. of American culture. Politicians are controlled by money. Yeah. The media is controlled by money. Everyone has taken the payoff. Everyone is in it for the payoff. And for a man to reach the age that de Blasio reached, at the level he's been working at, to still be living in a normal person's home, a very normal person's home, that is a remarkable fact. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to govern well or things are going to go well. But in a world where everyone is in it for the ultimate payoff and everything is being controlled by that desire, that's a remarkable outlier fact about him.
I think what was interesting was...
Anne, will you jump in before we move to another subject?
No, I'm just happy with our new mayor of Minneapolis. She's a woman. She's the first woman of a major city. So I'm thrilled. I'm happy for Mr. de Blasio, too, but he's sort of 2,000 miles removed from me.
I think what was most interesting about this whole campaign was when his daughter came out and made that statement using the internet as a way to talk about her personal issues. I wonder if this is kind of what is important about what's happening now is that people are getting in front of these issues and the fact that we can now talk about them. I thought it was interesting that they really kind of grabbed this by the horn, made sure it was talked about, made sure she was the one to answer to it first before it was discovered. I do have some friends who believe naively that perhaps with this new shift in New York that maybe we're getting beyond race. I know people are tired of talking about race. We tried it with Obama thinking we were getting beyond race. That didn't work out, obviously. Maybe we're not moving necessarily beyond race, but maybe we're comfortable, more comfortable with race and diversity now. Perhaps.
Here's the odd thing about the daughter's story was, and I haven't been able to fact check this, what I read this week was that the whole New York press knew about this situation during the campaign, and no one ran with it, which is really very strange and unusual given the way the press has worked over the past 20 years. I just find it hard to believe that's true. The report I read said even the New York Post knew about it and just chose to ignore it, let it go. That's very strange press behavior given our norms of recent decades.
Go ahead, Anne, then I want to move on to the next subject.
No, I guess I think that I'm not sure why this is a racial issue, because his wife is African-American. He's solidly white. So this seems to be bigger than it really is at some level, right? Or am I missing something here?
I guess it's really more so the face of diversity, that when you look at the de Blasio family, I mean, you see diversity represented in the family, even though he is solidly white. I'm not sure what solidly white means. He's white, and she's an African-American, and the children are biracial, that when you look at what the research is saying is going to happen in this country by 2040, when races begin to get mixed up, you have more diversity. You have whites being the minority, Hispanics now being the majority, that perhaps that's what the new America is going to look like. We're talking about moving beyond these issues.
I agree with that. I mean, a couple of shows ago, I was saying, you know, I live on a college campus. It is multiracial these days. And I think those of us who are in the baby boom generation don't understand how the new generation has really gone beyond the old racial divides that we still kind of talk about as if they're still reality. I agree with you.
Edward?
Yeah, let me make a final point on this, because I know you want to move to another topic. But I think what's wonderful about this, and I think what one of the guests was trying to say, was the fact that this young black girl has a voice and has a platform on which to express such personal issues and has an audience for that, right? I think is what's important. And I think that's overall why race matters in the de Blasio family. But specifically, sitting here on Frederick Douglass and 123rd, which is where I am right now, New York looks like that family. And so should not the leadership, of New York look like that family? And since the vast majority of New Yorkers live in houses like that or in apartments like that, should not their leaders understand where they're coming from and what they need and how the city's structural and economic and political apparatus must change in order to serve the people. That, I think, is what's important here, that you don't have a billionaire living in the sky saying it's God's will that a young black girl and her family should live in squalor with rats and roaches. That's not God's will, and Bill de Blasio's election, I think, will at least change some of the thinking around these issues.
And yeah, and we'll see how this all plays out. And I think that what you just said is true about how most of New York lives. And it made me think immediately of the connection between de Blasio and Pope Francis.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Also, the kind of shaking up his world in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, being named the new Pope, the Cardinal from Buenos Aires, who again, much like Pope John the 23rd, since we raised this, we'll just take a couple minutes on this before we move into Trayvon Martin.
Right.
But Pope John the 23rd was put in as Pope in 1963. People think, oh, he's not going to last. He's going to be a quiet Pope. And then he shook the entire Roman Catholic world and religious world up with Vatican II and changing the nature of the Church fundamentally. And here we have Pope Francis doing the exact same thing.
I'm very excited about Pope Francis, not just because I teach at Loyola University. We're happy to have a Jesuit as a pope, so we were very excited about that. But even listening to his first address of 2014, where he called for this spirit of community, this end to violence, and then the fact that he moved away from his prepared notes to ask two very fundamental questions. What's happening in the heart of man, and what is happening in the heart of humanity? Saying that it is time to stop. He has a heart for those that are poor and disenfranchised, those that are on the fringes of society. Like, I'm very moved by him. I am not Catholic, and I am very interested in what is happening in the Catholic Church because of Pope Francis. He has energized this spirit around the Catholic Church, perhaps being the leader to move us into this new era where those that don't have our concern, have our love, have our focus, and have our attention.
He also, one of the things he did, a couple of things that he did at friends of mine, a lot of friends of mine who were Catholic and go to church all the time, a couple of them said to me, when he got up there and spoke the first time, he didn't say, before he said a prayer over anybody else, he looked at them and said, pray for me.
Yeah.
For a pope to say pray for me was like turning the tide, theologically speaking.
Yeah.
And he also just was basically saying, let's get over this. Stop worrying about whether people are gay or not. Let's deal with issues.
And I'm so encouraged by that because I'm both Catholic and gay. And I think that it changes the way people see God. You know, it's so sad that we believe in these institutions so much that we actually forget the whole purpose of them. But I think Pope Francis is that wonderful example. In a weird way, he's the one man machine of Occupy the Church, right? It's like this Occupy movement is taking over even the church. You know, Bill de Blasio is occupying New York. Barack Obama is trying to occupy America. The Pope Francis is occupying the church. And so, yes, Christ was all about serving the needs of the poor and the disenfranchised, and hung out with prostitutes and lepers. Like, is this not the point? Even if it's all parable, right? Even if God does not exist, even though I believe he does, but even if he didn't, isn't the point for humanity's purposes that we love each other as ourselves, right? And that's what Pope Francis is about, and I'm very grateful that he's on the international stage.
Anne McCarthy, a thought on this before we move ahead?
I just adore Pope Francis. For all the reasons that the others were talking about. He's taken us Catholics away from the issues of gay marriage and birth control and abortion to the core of the church, which is social justice and working for the poor. So.
Let me offer a companion name to Pope Francis, who I haven't really, as someone who's raised Catholic, I haven't really been able to follow. I'll be honest. A companion name, Malala, whose last name I still can't pronounce.
Oh, yeah.
Anyone who hasn't watched her address to the UN on the day of her 16th birthday last summer, it's on YouTube. It comes up right away. You know, the great souls don't come along very often, and it's odd to talk about a 16-year-old as a great soul, but this is one of the most unusual people who has come on the world stage in a long time. I was stunned when I watched her speech in which she self-confidently allied herself with the great spirits going back to the Lord Buddha and Jesus Christ and the prophet who was most merciful. I mean, she is an astonishing—now, she's 16 years old. There's no telling what is going to happen in her life. But she is an astonishing presence on the world stage. I saw an interview with her last weekend on C-SPAN, and again, this is just not a normal person. This is a very unusual person.
But if you listen to her speech and then go read Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail, you can see some of the parallels between.
She has studied nonviolence. Yeah, the Pashtun people apparently have a history of nonviolent
resistance. Oh, they do.
Yes.
You can see it in what she's doing.
No, absolutely. She is not just a sweet young lady who's got warm heart. She has studied.
I've locked in his name, but one of Gandhi's partners in nonviolence was a Pashtun leader.
Right.
His name, I'm blocking, something Khan. And Malala Yousafzai. She's also grabbed the hearts and minds of a lot of young people across the globe.
And women, young girls.
And young girls across the globe because of the power in her. When I saw her speak, I wasn't going to think. I'm glad you mentioned her because that is a big piece of this year's events. I think when I saw her speak, I think it was on what's the guy's name? The Daily Show.
Jon Stewart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She was with Jon Stewart. First of all, that was the first time I noticed that the effects of her being shot. She looks like she's semi paralyzed on one side of her body, and you can tell from her face and the way she moves one arm. But that even in some ways made the power and beauty of who she was.
Mm-hmm.
Greater.
All the more powerful.
Well, John was still trying to be kind of snarky, jokey, and it sort of doesn't work around the great souls.
It doesn't.
And, we lost one of the last century's great souls in the last few weeks, and they don't come along very often.
Right.
It kind of goes in with the guest was saying earlier about this young black girl having a stage. Here's another young girl having a stage, being able to take the platform and speak and be articulate and have people understand where she's coming from. I was so moved by her talk, and I've been following her story.
Yeah, and she's also, like Gabrielle Giffords, I think, a miracle that is so, that's born of a tragedy, right?
Right.
That forces us to acknowledge what's wrong. Right. And so I think that's what's most powerful. Like, you cannot turn away because you are. It's like Christ at the Transfiguration. You're so fixed by the light. You cannot turn away. Like this girl, like he calls her a great soul. I just think she is an agent of the light. And you must see it and you must open your eyes and let it into your soul. It's a beautiful thing.
We have to take a break here. When we come back from this break, we're going to kind of talk a bit about some of the things that may be more political. Look at the Affordable Health Care Act that is now ensconced, and what that means and what that meant for this year's political battles, the shutdown, what's happening there around the Republican and the Democratic divide. And, of course, we'll come back starting off with Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman and all that kind of is encumbered. And the law that most people don't know about that's being debated in Wisconsin now for police accountability, which we'll talk about. It's all tied into that. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Garner, Autumn Leaves. We'll be hearing more of Trombone Shorty coming up as well, and Yosef Lateef. Reminding you here on the Way Back to Conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, go to www.mecu.com. Log on to the Steiner Show .org and right there you can click on the banner. All the information will be there for MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Also reminding you that Thursday, January the 2nd, WEA is celebrating jazz in the community at Phase 10 Restaurant and Lounge. Thursday Night Live, hosted by WEAA's own bass man, features area guitarist Michael Reitzik, who you heard this morning on The Blend. The broadcast begins at 8 p.m. More details online at phase10.com or 410-462-2010. And Michael Reitzik is an incredible jazz guitarist and a really good guy. You don't want to miss that one if you can help it. We are here with Bob Sornby, editor of the Daily Howler, Dr. Kay Whitehead, who is Assistant Professor of Communication and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African American Studies at Loyola University, Edward Wyckoff Williams, Contributing Editor to the Root, Political Contributor and Special Correspondent with Al Jazeera America. He's a columnist and political analyst appearing on MSNBC, ABC, CBS, Washington, and nationally syndicated radio, and Dr. Ann McCarthy, Dean of the Business School at Hamline University in Minneapolis and former Republican candidate for Comptroller of Maryland. We want to hear from you on this year and what you thought about this past year politically and every other way. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We're going to come to the phones after this quick. We start off with Trayvon Martin. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com or log on to our Facebook pages, which I'm about to check. 410-319-8888 is a number here. So let's talk a bit about the issue of Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman, but the larger issues involved in this and what this said about America. One of the things that I think that I read in Sherilyn Ifill's piece in The Root, which she'll be on talking about this in our show next week, but one of the lines there was, you know, that Trayvon Martin was not even in the running to be considered on the cover of Time magazine. So what our thoughts are about what the effect of this has had on America and what this means for us as we enter 2014. Edward, go ahead.
I mean, this has been very close to my heart, and I've interviewed the parents and all that.
Right.
I think that what you just said speaks to the fact of how invisible men still are these many years after Ralph Ellison wrote the book. I think that black boys' lives are still counted as 3/5, and I think that that's what was so demoralizing about the verdict. But yet, he has inspired a young generation of activists. His death has inspired a young generation of activists. And, you know, there are people out here like the Hoodies Up movement that's being led by Daniel Murray, who I think would be great on the show, actually. I think you need to be talking to him. These are people who are investing in getting young people involved in movements of social justice and social change. And so I think as much as things change, they stay the same, but that's not necessarily a bad thing in that we are being stimulated and organized and inspired in ways that we wouldn't without these kinds of tragedies. But at the end of the day, I think what the Zimmerman acquittal showed is that, you know, Emmett Till and Trayvon Martin, the time has changed, the generations have changed, but they are still structural problems in American society around race. And so, as one of your guests was saying earlier, we do not live in a post-racial society, and we shouldn't pretend to. But what we can be excited about, I guess, is that we're talking about things and evolving a conversation, which is important.
I think this issue is very close to my heart from a slightly different perspective than Edward's. It's because I'm raising two African-American boys, a 12-year-old and an 11-year-old. And we have talked so much about Trayvon Martin, but also about how to negotiate race in our society, how to negotiate and nurture masculinity in our society. How can they move into spaces and not be perceived to be dangerous? How can they speak up for themselves and learn how to speak out in such a way that people will listen and not tune them out and become afraid of them because they expect that something is going to happen? I mean, Trayvon Martin allowed us to have some very touchy and serious conversations with my 12-year-old who turns 13 on January 11th, and he wanted to know, what does this mean for me? Does it mean I can't wear a hoodie? Does it mean I can't go outside? Does it mean I can't buy Skittles? For a 12-year-old mind, it broke down to those small things. And I began at the beginning. Let's talk about what it means to be black and male and invisible and perceived to be dangerous and perceived to be a criminal in this society. How do you change that norm? Even if I send you to the best schools in America, even if you go to Harvard, you can drive in the wrong neighborhood and be assumed guilty of a crime that you didn't commit, but the crime of breathing and moving and being while black is in existence.
Anne?
To me, this is a tragedy and a travesty of justice. It's just, I'm still in shock. It's just unhappy. It's an embarrassment to us as Americans that this happened, I think. And that there's, I just hope some good can come out of it. It's Edward and I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
But Kay.
Kay, thank you, have said, because that would at least mean that it wasn't in vain. But George Zimmerman is an is an embarrassment.
Right. Right.
And it's just sad. It's sad.
It is sad.
One other thing I wanted to bring out, we've just talked about two young ladies who have been able to bring light out of tragedy. I'm thinking about de Blasio's daughter. I'm thinking about what happened with the young woman who was shot. But I think about a situation where a young woman was not able to take control of that platform, Rachel Gentile, when she was sitting up there and having these testy exchanges. I mean, she was not polished. They did not assume her to be educated. She used African-American vernacular English, and she was dismissed. Over and over again, because she did not speak the way we wanted her to speak. She did not look the way. There's a lot of conversations about how dark she was, how heavy she was, which showed us even when someone wants to speak up and tell their story, if you're not speaking in a certain way, if you don't look a certain way, then you're not necessarily going to be listened to.
On the way to the phones, Bobby, you want to jump in?
I'm the outlier here. I think this was an embarrassing situation for American culture, but I think it was an embarrassment for the American media. From the earliest days, I think it was an embarrassment for emerging progressive and liberal media. I think MSNBC in the year 2012 invented tons of bogus information about this case. I don't think anyone knows to this day what happened that night in the dark in that gated community.
Except Zimmerman, who's not telling everything.
Well, he knows. I don't know that he's telling everything. That's because I don't know. I don't know whether what he's telling is accurate or not.
You are the outlier in that respect, because I think most black people and these black mothers in particular know exactly what happened.
I think there's something tragic about people
assuming that they cannot know just based off of what we've heard from both Gentile and just from the fact that the kid was literally just walking with Skittles, that we don't know what happened. And then in the aftermath,
we know he had Skittles.
Being arrested multiple times for domestic violence and putting guns in the faces of his girlfriends and wife. Please, 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 please don't act like we don't know. We do know.
If I could finish, you don't know what happened that night. You can say you know what happened, but you don't know what happened. I mean, that's, you know, that's just, unless you can tell me.
That's not the issue.
The issue, I think, that Bob is trying to say is that the media took a hold of this, and in a way, we don't know, because the media fell down on job. To talk about a witness based on her weight or the darkness of the color of her skin, that's a media problem. And that's partially because that's what we tune into, but it's also what they think we want to hear.
I
think the media distorts a lot of our conversation, and we don't hold them accountable.
That was more social media rather than media. I don't think a lot of media really went after Rachel Gentile. Social media went crazy.
But I agree with Edward. We may not know the facts of what happened, but we know the larger narrative that has taken place, because it takes place all the time with African-American males in this country.
Even though
he was just walking, the fact is he was just walking and perceived to be guilty of a crime of just walking in what was assumed to be the wrong neighborhood. We may not know if he had Skittles or iced tea. We've talked about that. We've laughed about the hoodies. We may not know those minute facts, but we know the bigger narrative that's at place here around the perceived criminality of African-American males in this country.
I do want to move on to the healthcare issue and open the phones here. But when we come back from this phone call to 410-319-8888, I think that part of what we just heard just now in this conversation on the Steiner Show is at the heart of the discussion in America. And it's not a discussion between the people who are racist or non-racist. It's a discussion about how people's lives are lived in America and what it means to be black in America and the disconnect we all have from each other. This is a moment of disconnect in some senses. And I think it's an important thing to kind of wrestle with, I think. It's hard to wrestle with sometimes in a calm way, but I think it's important to do, because I think this is the discussion America has to have with itself to move ahead to the next step.
I think it was another wake-up call as well.
As the outlier, let me say this.
Go ahead, Bob.
In its first news report, which was a full-scale news report, the New York Times embarrassed itself badly. MSNBC, for several months in 2012, disgraced itself. Now, there are so many issues of racial injustice in this country. My God, I mean, the world is teeming with racial injustice, starting, let's say, with what goes on in their schools. These issues don't get discussed. They don't get discussed well. Many people seized on this particular incident. News organizations disgraced themselves. The New York Times disgraced itself. We take us hours to go into what they did in their first report. I write about the media. The media disgraced itself in this area, in my view.
But see, I think it's two issues. I think I agree with Kay and Edward. This is a reality that African American young men face every day, and it is. And thank God we finally started talking about it. But to me, there's another issue here, and that issue is the frightening part of the Second Amendment running amok. That somebody can chase somebody down and be acquitted under a stand your ground law. That we let people walk around with guns, and now in many states, concealed weapons as vigilantes. And what has happened? What is happening to our law and order and society in the sense that, you know, there are these people who just take it upon themselves to, you know, like, decide that they're a one-man jury. That's wrong, and we haven't even addressed that. And I guess perhaps because I'm out in the West, where gun rights is even more, you know, important than back East, it's I see it every day.
I just want to add a third issue to that I just felt it was a wake-up call for some of us as parents who have tried to move our children into independent schools, who've tried to educate them, who've tried to give them every opportunity to be successful. It was a wake-up call that we cannot buy our way out of certain situations. You cannot educate your children enough to not be in certain situations.
I think to that point, The guest who says he doesn't know what happened, I think that you would know what happened if it were your child. I think that there's a cognitive dissonance at the heart of that kind of conversation, which tries to focus on the media coverage of it as opposed to the actual human experience of what happened. So, and I think for black brothers and black boys and young black men like me in particular, with all my education, knowing that I can walk the streets and be shot dead and nobody care and nothing be done about it and there be no recompense, is problematic, and it's at the heart of the Three-Fifths Compromise that this country is built on. I think that we acquiesce, like in The Bluest Eye, Toni Morrison wrote, we acquiesce and say the victim had no right to live. I will not tolerate that kind of conversation.
Bob, final thought for me.
I don't think you know what happened that night, and I don't think I know what happened that night.
And I think you're acquiescing in saying the victim had the right to live.
When did I say the victim? Really, can you not hear yourself how ridiculous that is? Do you not hear
how ridiculous that is? I don't think you understand how ridiculous what you're saying is. That's what's ridiculous.
Huh?
Let me just kind of intervene here.
As I said, I'm sorry, I'm the outlier, but you know, I would have rather not discuss this topic. But I'll stand on what I've said.
Well, I think the outlier position.
Let me get to the phones here. 410-319-8888. And Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hello.
You're on the air, Bruce.
Yeah. So Edward is ridiculous. So I understand Edward feels a certain way because he's black, and you know, maybe Edward is being a little biased because he's black. So, you know, you don't know. You can't assume. And what you want to get from the howler is saying, I agree with him. You can't assume that. And for Edward to say, compare the kid that was killed in the 50s, not compare Trayvon.
Emmett Till.
Wait a minute. Yeah, to compare what Emmett Till was a tragedy to what happened to Emmett Till was definitely an act of hatred and racism. So what I really wanted to mention, on C-SPAN about a week and a half ago, on Book TV, there's a guy named Jack Kasmel, author. If I Had a Son, Race, Guns, and the Railroading of George Zimmerman, when he lays it out that George Zimmerman wasn't a racist, didn't in any way stalk him. Went over the reputation and history of George Zimmerman before that, and the reason why he became a member of the Neighborhood Watch is because someone in his community, it wasn't a gated community, it was home invasion, it was a black woman, and he took an obligation to protect his neighborhood. But instead, the media, the civil rights people, the president of the NAACP, and a number of other people went down and raised all kind of hell to try to put the information a certain way. They were biased. They were looking to give Gerb to George Zimmerman for political reasons and for propaganda.
Thank you, Bruce.
You know, Ben Crump's family attorney told me that his biggest fear, this was just before the verdict, that his biggest fear was that if Zimmerman was acquitted, you would have a change in the way people saw these kinds of situations, that they would begin to try to find justifications. I think that that's what's happening right now.
Well, let me go back to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Meredith, you're on the air.
Happy New Year, everybody. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I think one of the stories that most affected my heart, besides Trayvon, were the three young women who were finally found after 10 and 12 years of captivity. And the conversations that we don't have about human trafficking of young girls and women in this society.
Yep.
And it goes back to what Zimmerman, he has a history of violence against women.
Yes,
he does.
Yes.
A precursor to the murder of this child. So again, drawing a parallel, when do we really start talking about violence against children, young women, and older women, and how these things kind of converge, and how we aren't raising these men to say not just no to rape, but encouraging other young men to say no to rape. I mean, this is going on across the country, and I would just really like a really hardcore discussion on how we address this issue, because as you can see, persons with histories of violence against women, I mean, murder is the next step. I mean, you know, we see that, so I'd like you all to talk about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Meredith.
One of the things that the caller addressed, that there are some places where these conversations are happening. I think one of the things maybe we can talk about is the power of Twitter in 2013 to bring some light to these situations. There are conversations that are currently happening on Twitter about this idea of rape and how men actually see rape and how some men don't see rape as a crime, don't see rape as something about power, that it's about sex and it's actually about power. And just speaking just once more to the Zimmerman incident, I'm saddened by the fact that we pretend as if we don't know what happened. We pretend if it's the media's fault. We pretend as if Zimmerman is an angel and that Trayvon was just guilty because he was in Zimmerman's neighborhood, as if your neighborhood can be blocks and blocks and you set the boundaries of what is your neighborhood and who can belong in that neighborhood, rather than dealing with the heart of this issue, which is around the way black men, young black men in particular, are seen in our society. We're not dealing with that. Some organizations are, but these are the bigger conversations that are not happening.
I loved what the caller said and how she elevated the conversation, because one of the things that we see, you know, particularly with the far right rising up against abortion and trying to take us back to a time when women had no rights over their own bodies, and then this conversation around the violence against women's bodies, I think shows that at the heart of what's occurring in America is this culture war. And I think that this is being waged around who has power and who does not, and who has the right to live and who does not. And I think that that is a conversation, like you just said, that is happening, and it's happening on Twitter, it's happening in communities, it's happening on platforms like Mark Steiner's. And I think that that's important, that even though we might disagree, we are still talking about it, and that is progress.
And
I agree. And Meredith, the caller said great. I mean, we haven't talked really about the violence against women and human trafficking, and it's something that's difficult for us to talk about at the same time that women's rights are being systematically in Wisconsin and Texas and all over the West and Midwest, you know, curtailed.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, the Ariel Castro thing that hit me, because we had a program about trafficking on this show not long after that, not because of that, because we had planned to do it anyway, but one of the things that came up with the incredible numbers of people who are sexually abused within families and homes, and how that leads to human trafficking, and how it leads to prostitution, and it leads to many things. And that when we look at people like Ariel Castro, this is just the tip of the iceberg. We don't know what happens next door to us. We don't know what's going on in these locked and closed houses in our own neighborhoods. And this really is a rampant human problem that I think we're just beginning to undertake, just like we undertook for hundreds of years to end slavery. The whole idea of what's happening to women and what men are allowed to do is now just, I think, coming to the fore.
That's an excellent point.
I think that's something really to address. Yeah. Well, one of the things we didn't get to, and we probably don't have much time to get to it now, we'll have to come back and do it in a longer stretch, and I'm gonna, before I hit this last phone call here, is the ACA.
Yeah.
Just very quickly.
Wait, very quickly, it's going to be just fine.
Yeah. Bob, you want to lead off?
You know what we didn't get to was the NSA, and I have only one thing to say about that.
And we didn't get to that either.
30 million people who lost their credit cards because of Target are more concerned about criminals taking their identities than the NSA knowing who they call and what they say.
Yes.
We didn't get to the WPA, and we need to bring it back, but...
There's a lot we haven't gotten to.
I'm just horrified by the ACA and what's going on. I'm horrified for where this could lead us as a nation
in terms of,
it's such an emblem of a potential emblem of the failure of the potential failure of progressive legislation. Now, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen in the new year. We don't know how the current situation is going to evolve. It may turn out that everything sort of works out. Not that this was ever the cleanest solution to the healthcare problem. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, my God, to see the deadlines keep being extended. It's almost like if the right wing invented a parody of progressive legislation designed to reinforce all their themes about the government can't do anything right, blah, 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 blah. A great deal of what's happening would have been their invention, and I find it horrifying to see this playing out. Now, maybe it'll work out. I'm not saying it won't. We don't know.
I would encourage people to go back and read Michael Moore's op-ed that was in the New York Times yesterday.
Agreed.
Where he talked about the ACA, and he had what I thought was one of the best lines when he said the president was trying to put the lipstick on the dog in the carry on top of Romney's car, which sums up how we've taken Romney Care into Obamacare and all of the things that are happening with Affordable Care. But he also outlined some of the good things that are happening with it. People who are benefiting from it. I think that if we begin to unravel ACA, maybe one of the best places to start is with that op-ed and then trying to determine whether or not this is going to be something in the long run that's going to be good for people who don't have
healthcare. But if people don't sign up, there's going to be a problem. And you know how we got from the idea...
They're signing up
in certain numbers, but not in gigantic numbers. And the idea, how we got from the idea that this was a mandate to, well, maybe 3 million will sign up. I mean, what happened? You know, the whole idea that there was a mandate involved here, it's becoming more and more clear there is no mandate. No one's acting like there's a mandate. The mandate is sort of required to make the whole program work, pretty much.
Mark, I know you got to go soon, and I know this has to wrap up.
I want to get Ann's voice back in here as well. Go ahead, and then I want to get Ann back in here.
Yeah, let me just say really, really quickly, we are forgetting all the working poor who have already signed up for Medicaid, right? That just goes to show, I think it's almost 1 million people. That just goes to show how many hardworking people in this country, hardworking people, are benefiting from Obamacare, and that is a blessing.
Ann?
I would say that human progress comes in fits and starts and is never perfectly organized from the beginning. And the ACA is working. And could it be better? Yes, but we'll get there and we'll tweak it at the edges. And by the way, Bob, it was a mandate only because the president needed the insurance companies to sign on. Now, insurance stocks skyrocketed after that because guess what? They were going to make lots of money. So maybe those insurance companies make a little less money and still survive because it doesn't quite become a mandate.
Maybe it's the first step.
But the potential problem is within the exchanges. If enough people don't sign up and enough people in certain categories don't sign up, then the exchanges don't end up not working. So, and the whole thing is just a big Rube Goldberg invention. This is not Obama's fault because we can't have a sensible national health care plan for various reasons. It's not Obama's fault. It's not his fault. But it's a very complex, confused system because of our failures as a nation. And it's not clear yet that it's going to work. And I think it troubles me that the problems have been existing that do exist. It may work out fine.
But it's what Ann said, that progress in this country is made with fits and starts. This is probably the first step, one would hope, towards getting us towards universal quality health care. Something had to be done. Something has been done. It's not working perfectly, from the website to the mandates to the deadlines, but it's the first step. It's what Edward said, the million people who've signed up who did not have health care, who were part of the working poor and still are in a number of ways. It's a start, and we need to begin to build on this start. Obama cannot do it alone, and we shouldn't expect him to do it alone.
Well, maybe in some ways, some people might argue that President Obama was part of the problem because
What part of the solution?
He spoke in 2008 about the public option has to be on the table.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He never fought for that. Right. When he got to be president of the United States, he canceled that out as part of the discussion. And I think that and stepped away and allowed Congress to deal with it, which allowed the insurance companies and the Republican Party to come in and become the people who designed the bill, who then turned against the bill. At least,
mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, that's part of the problem. I mean, I think that from the very beginning, and by the way, that's what I'll be talking about this Saturday morning at 10 o'clock on Melissa Harris-Perry. I'll be on the panel discussing this health care law.
And our politics
Nice plug. Our
national politics is flying apart at this time, and it's not clear where that's going to go. And it's just it's a potentially troubling situation.
Well, I might say this has been an incredibly interesting panel. The four of you are always a joy to have on the air with us. I really do mean that. And it's great to have all four of you here. Bob Sorenby is editor of the Daily Howler. We're going to go out here with Trombone Shorty. It's his birthday. Going on with hurricane season. I love Trombone Shorty. We hear him going out under us as we go to the next hour. And Dr. Kay Whitehead from Loyola University, professor of Africana and African Studies and Communications. Edward Wyckoff Williams, contributing editor at The Root and political contributor and special correspondent with Al Jazeera America, and a columnist you can read everywhere, all over the place. MSNBC, CBS, he's all over the place. And Dr. Ann McCarthy, the dean of the Business College at Hamline University. Thank all four of you for being here for this National News Roundup at the end of the year. Or the beginning of the year.
Yes.
The beginning of the year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Mark.
Thank you so much.
And we're going to take a brief break and come back, and we're going to switch to a local roundtable. What happened last year? What are we expecting this year? Stay with us.